A domestic disturbance leads to a man being shot by a highway patrol officer. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about the governor's new plan to help Montanans be healthy. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry catches up with some rain-drenched bikers. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with officials with the Montana Preservation Alliance about saving endangered historic places. A man was killed by law enforcement officers responding to a report of domestic disturbance in St. Regis. The State Justice Department says Mineral County Sheriff's officers responding to a family disturbance at 6 p.m. yesterday heard a gunshot come from the residence. Four Montana Highway Patrol officers responded to a request for backup. The Justice Department says the suspect left the residence on foot and armed with a rifle. 2 hours later, officers found the man about a block from the residence. The man would not follow commands to drop his rifle. The initial investigation indicates he raised his weapon toward the officers and was shot by a trooper. The trooper was placed on administrative leave. The State Division of Criminal Investigation is investigating. The name of the suspect was not released.
And in other news from around the state, Missoula County prosecutors say a 28-year-old man charged with intentionally setting a fire that severely damaged a low-income housing unit did so because he had received an eviction notice. Travis David Crosby made an initial appearance in justice court yesterday on a charge of felony arson. Justice of the Peace John Oblin set his bail at $75,000. Court records say the charges against Crosby were filed after other residents of Vantage Villa apartment building told investigators that Crosby admitted starting the fire. Deputy County Attorney Jason Marks said Crosby told detectives that he used matches to set fire to a chair in his apartment because he was angry about the eviction notice. The fire displaced 40 households.
A norovirus outbreak believed to have started at Yellowstone National Park may have affected around 200 people at both Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Park. About 50 visitors have reported symptoms associated with norovirus, a stomach flu that is easily spread by touching an infected person or contaminated surfaces. Up to 150 park employees may have been infected, although not all of those cases have been confirmed. The outbreak is believed to have started with a group of tourists who visited the Mammoth Hot Springs area in Yellowstone on June 7th. They complained of stomach flu symptoms, and within 48 hours, employees who worked with visitors also reported being sick. Physician's assistant Michael Takagi told the Jackson Hole Daily that the outbreak is one of the most significant ones he's seen.
As we reported yesterday, a state Supreme Court ruling has opened the way for dozens of Yellowstone Park bison to be transferred to the Fort Belknap Reservation. Some bison have already been relocated to the Fort Peck Reservation as part of a state and tribal agreement to transfer disease-free bison that wander out of Yellowstone Park. Some ranchers and property rights advocates had tried to stop the transfer out of concern that bison could harm their cattle and grazing. Many of the bison that wander out of the park currently are slaughtered. The director of the Fort Belknap Fish and Game Department, Mark Azure, says that slaughter is the one reason the tribes want to take the park bison.
I don't know that we do that to any other animal in this state. It's just hard to see for us that here's an animal that sustained our people for centuries in this region. It's the last free roaming herd that once roamed this region, to see it, because it stepped over an imaginary line that it's put down. It means more, more to us than it's a nuisance, for sure. We can't and won't stand by and watch that happen. So that's why we got involved in this.
We'll have a feature interview with Mark Azure about the importance of bison to the tribes next week during Montana Evening Edition.
Federal officials have approved plans by a Montana Indian tribe to lease 1.4 billion tons of coal reserves to a Wyoming company that's moving aggressively to expand its exports to Asia. The deal between the Crow Tribe and the Cloud Peak Energy involves more coal than the U.S. consumes annually. Today's announcement that the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs approved the project allows Cloud Peak to begin exploration on the Crow Reservation. Cloud Peak has pending agreements to ship more than 20 million tons of coal to Asia each year through proposed West Coast ports. Officials in Washington and Oregon oppose those ports for environmental reasons, but federal officials say they plan only limited environmental reviews of the projects.
The FBI is stepping in to lead the investigation into a state senator and Blackfeet tribal leader accused of fleeing an officer who suspected him of drunken driving. A search warrant application filed Tuesday says the FBI is investigating possible charges of obstructing a peace officer, driving under the influence, and reckless driving against Democratic Senator Shannon Ogier. Ogier, who also is a Blackfeet council member, was pulled over on the reservation May 26th. An affidavit by FBI Special Agent Jason Grendy says Ogier had been drinking with his family at a Cut Bank bar before leaving with his mother. The affidavit says Ogier told the deputy who pulled them over he had no jurisdiction. Ogier allegedly revved the engine and left after the deputy tried to grab his keys.
A former Butte Silver Bow Justice of the Peace who was given deferred sentences in two cases related to his use of methadone has been arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence of some type of drug. Jefferson County Sheriff Craig Doolittle says 67-year-old Robert Bob Lee was arrested earlier today on suspicion of misdemeanor driving under the influence of drugs on Interstate 90 just east of Butte. Lee's bail was set at $700 for the DUI and $25,000 for the alleged probation violation. Last month, Lee was given a 3-year deferred sentence for doctor shopping in order to obtain methadone. The drug charges were filed in January 2012, just after Lee received a deferred sentence for negligent endangerment for allegedly driving under the influence of methadone in November 2010.
Governor Steve Bullock is announcing a new initiative to improve health outcomes in the state. The plan outlines a series of strategies looking to address some of the state's biggest health and safety concerns, ranging from smoking to motor vehicle fatalities. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says many of these strategies still involve a fair amount of personal responsibility from citizens.
Department of Public Health and Human Services Director Richard Opper estimates his staff has been working on compiling the information for this new initiative for more than a year. It shows cardiovascular diseases and cancer jointly accounting for about half of all deaths in Montana. Tobacco use remains the single most preventable cause of death, and increasing obesity rates are leading to a growing epidemic of diabetes in the state. Opper says his department's job is to look for ways to lower those stats and improve the delivery of healthcare.
One of the best ways to do that is to come up with a plan, figure out what the exact status of the health of the citizens of the state is. What percentage of smokers do we have? What percentage of pregnant women smoke? Obesity statistics.
And that plan is called Big Sky, New Horizons, A Healthier Montana. Governor Steve Bullock unveiled it during a meeting of the Montana Association of Public Health Officials.
When it comes to health care, we will and we have and will continue to have grand policy debates about who pays and how much they should pay. But what we shouldn't lose sight of is there's so much that we can do.
And what this plan outlines are things the administration can do without the approval of the legislature. It lays out 6 major priorities ranging from preventing chronic conditions to reducing substance abuse. And then 78 different strategies are identified to achieve those goals. These are things like promoting the implementation of tobacco-free school campuses all the way to improving electronic health records. DPHHS Director Opper says the department will be looking at almost 30 different health indicators to track the program's progress. He says the department is setting benchmarks to reach specific goals, but he acknowledges most of these goals require citizens comply with the state's health recommendations and take their own initiative.
We don't have the ability to necessarily enforce what are unquestionably good ideas on people. So there are educational programs that we can undertake and enhance that will at least give people better tools to make better decisions in the future.
Opper says many of these programs are already underway. Others are still in the implementation process. DPHHS worked on preparing the Big Sky New Horizons health plan with the help of more than 130 different organizations. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A bull moose's walking tour of Bozeman ended when state wildlife officials tranquilized the animal and released it in the Gallatin National Forest. The moose wandered around the city this morning with an entourage of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks wardens, police officers, and reporters trying to capture photos and video of the journey. The moose made appearances near Montana State University, Bozeman's Law and Justice Building, the Bozeman Daily Chronicle, and a grocery store. Eventually, wildlife officials were able to catch up with the animal and hit it with a tranquilizer dart. It was loaded into a trailer to be released in the Spanish Creek area of the Gallatin National Forest.
Mountain bikers have been cycling the back roads of Montana, hitting the pavement when necessary, but mainly staying off the main roads as they head south along the Great Divide mountain bike route. Around the second weekend in June, each year the Tour Divide race follows this bike route. It starts in Banff, Alberta, and continues for more than 2,700 miles south along the Continental Divide to Antelope Wells, New Mexico. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry caught up with some of the cyclists as they passed through Whitefish a few days into their adventure.
Outside of Glacier Cyclery in Whitefish, a group of six mountain bikers wear rain jackets, their mountain bikes strapped with bags carrying various gear, with maps under clear, waterproof shields fixed onto handlebars. Alex Mangini of Austin, Texas, via New Jersey, says the current conditions are less than ideal.
We can deal with a little cool, we can deal with a little rain, but when you mix that together and it's super cold and super rainy, it's absolutely miserable. Like the first day, day one of this entire race, our spirits were so high, we were happy we're finally out here, and then it pours rain and it's freezing and we all wanted to quit, we were all miserable, and it wasn't just cool. So that's why we want to get down south as fast as possible, warmer weather, warm rain, if anything, so that's our goal, warm weather.
Chris Schuler of Switzerland puts on a shower cap before taking off for the day's ride.
I do race at home a lot, but not long distance.
What made you decide to do this one?
Adventure.
Schuler didn't know this group of people he's cycling across the Flathead with before the race. They met up along the trail. The same is true for Javier Serrano of Dallas, Texas.
It's my first time doing it, and I'm just happy to be out here and not working and just riding every day. I'm meeting all these great people, making friends, and it's just an awesome time.
Allison Seeger of South Dakota is working to raise a dollar a mile as she rides.
I teach on Rosebud Indian Reservation, and I've been teaching fifth graders, and now I'm moving to high school, so I'm setting up a college fund for when my fifth graders graduate high school and go to college to help them pay for expenses.
A link to Seeger's site is available at mtpr.org. The 2,700 miles mostly follows dirt roads, single-track trails, and four-wheeler trails.
Today's a little bit different. Today should be mostly paved roads, depending on how far we're going. For the next about 40 miles, I would say it's like 80% paved, more or less. So we should be able to make good time, even in the rain. Who knows? There's always the unexpected.
In the back of Glacier Cyclery, bike repair is ongoing.
What do we run into mostly on Great Divide racers? Brake pads? We go through a lot of brake pads.
Brake pads and tires.
Tires, yeah.
Various squeaks.
Squeaks, creaks, groans,
yep.
Grunts.
Yep. Boxing bikes to send back home.
We do a few of those this year.
Owner Ron Brunk and mechanic Mike Metter have biked sections of the Great Divide route. Brunk says he's traveled between the border and Helena down through the Swan Valley.
It's a gorgeous section. There's an old road cut that's eroded away, so it's been gated on each end, and there's about a 3 or 4 mile section there, I think, that's turned into a single track, and it's got just incredible views because the road just kind of washes away and drops away into this deep little canyon, and then you look across that and you look right into the Bob Marshall. I mean, it's just gorgeous country.
Metter is planning to bike parts of the route this fall, adding side routes to the Divide Trail. He says the race kicks off in June, but he's not interested in racing.
Just being out in some of the country's most beautiful places on your bike, completely self-sufficient, with everything you need to live on your bike, riding as few or as many miles a day as you feel like riding.
After Banff, the route takes riders down along the edge of Glacier National Park, through the Swan, down to Yellowstone, then on through the Colorado Rockies, down to desert terrain as the Continental Divide reaches New Mexico. The Missoula-based Adventure Cycling Association mapped the route in the late 1990s, and the Tour Divide race has started gaining popularity with racers from across the country and the world over the past few years. It's called the world's longest off-pavement cycling route.
When it first started up, it was one guy that tried to set a record on it, and then it was another guy who tried to beat his record. I think the first one I remember had 7 entrants. And this year there's 140.
Metter credits the ride's growth and popularity to a documentary made called Ride the Divide, which the racers outside also reference as piquing their interest in this race.
So we're going that way?
Yeah, Elwood.
The bikers are ready, tires filled, gears sorted, and maps available as they crisscross south, away from one border and closer to the next. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Catherine Fry reporting from the Flathead.
I think we're home.
Yesterday, we told you the National Trust for Historic Preservation released its listing of America's 11 most endangered historic places. It includes sites from Maine to Alaska, and Montana's one-room schoolhouses join the list. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Montana Preservation Alliance Director of Preservation and Sustainability, Patty Dean, talks about the listing's significance. The 27-year-old Preservation Alliance works to document and save Montana's traditional buildings, landscapes, and cultures.
Maybe this is a bit of an oddball question, but why do you think, Ms. Dean, we collectively, we, humanity, on the one hand feel compelled to preserve our historic places and things, when on the other hand we seem so obsessed with pushing forward with everything from our policies to our technology, which changes by the month?
Well, I think that is a dynamic of being human, is at the same time we look back at the things which have meaning for us, which provide ourselves with our individual and community identities, but at the same time, because we are human, I think we do want to press on, and that's a dynamic tension that we work with all the time.
The National Trust for Historic Preservation has added historic rural schoolhouses of Montana to its most endangered historic places, a list for this year. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but it is what it is. What should we know about these schoolhouses?
These schoolhouses are at once emblematic of Montana history. They're in every corner of the state. Literally every one of our 56 counties has at least one rural schoolhouse extant in it. And they really embody the hopes and dreams and success and failures of Montanans throughout the decades.
Or hopes and dreams, what does that mean?
Well, one of the problems with a lot of these historic schoolhouses is that they are in communities that once were perhaps speculative ventures by the railroad during the homesteading era or other types of economic interests. And so the very reasons that they were established and built and brought a community together, when the economic reason for that particular community to exist is gone, such as, for example, the dismantling of the Milwaukee Railroad, that it takes away the reason for the community being there in the first place, which, of course, complicates it when you try to save it because the people who could assist in the saving have gone.
How important were these places to these rural outposts in the 19th and 20th centuries? Were they just used for schools or not?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of them, you know, schools often are a community center, either by default because it's the one substantial building that's in some of these smaller communities, or, you know, it's centrally located. But it really does unify and also boost the community, I would say, as well. So they're wonderful for us to look at. I mean, I think sometimes we tend to romanticize them a bit. Of course, that would have been the furthest thing from the community's minds when they built it, because they really were illustrating what values education had, what values they placed in the community and in the future. So they really are emblematic of the community as a whole.
In my mind's eye, I think of these buildings as super simple, small buildings with maybe a cupola and a bell, something right off the set of Little House on the Prairie. Is that too simplistic of you?
You know, I think that's certainly true for some of them, because they did certainly follow the evolving guidelines for educational buildings. You know, there was a whole science, if you will, during the Progressive Era, which is the time that a lot of these buildings date from, where they really were codifying what should be in a school and how it related back to values and educational goals. Having said that, however, you know, some of the, I think, the most exciting ones are of brick in the middle of the prairie. Now, where is that brick coming from? I mean, it's obviously being transported most likely by the railroad, because that is the raison d'etre for some of these communities. But one of my favorites is in Moccasin, Montana, which is a 1930s poured concrete building ornamented with metal escutcheons and shields and that sort of thing. And it's very visible from the highway. It's a little bit hidden by the bushes. But again, it shows the hopes and dreams, the permanence, the pride that these communities had in their schools and in their children.
And a measure of prosperity in that particular case, perhaps?
Absolutely, I would say, yes. Moccasin never quite made it, but it really is, you know, they really do manifest the values and the future.
Well, the key word to this list is endangered. Again, what's happening to these great old treasures to warrant them being placed on this list?
Well, some of it does relate back to the threats, both economic and physical, and they require different solutions. So as I was noting, the existence of these schools lies in the existence of the community. And in Montana, you know, the 2010 U.S. Census noted that 34 of our 56 counties lost population over the last decade. And indeed, some of our counties are now rendered as frontier, which is defined as a low population density of 80%. So, you know, they're isolated, the communities are gone. And then, too, you just have the ravages of time. I mean, in the preservation and sustainability fields, the best use for a historic building is its original use. And that, we realize that can't always be possible. So when you lose townspeople, you are losing the human capital that could make it into something new and something lasting. So it's a difficult situation. But I will say, happily, one of the great things that's come about in these past 2 years is that we've been working with the Montana History Foundation, which is a grant-making statewide nonprofit, and they have what's called the Preserve Montana Fund. And the net proceeds from Charlotte Caldwell's book, Vision and Voices, Montana's One-Room Schoolhouses, all of the net profits for that are going 100% to saving rural schoolhouses throughout Montana. They can be privately owned, they can be publicly owned, and we're doing everything with that funding from helping people replace roofs to painting to new foundations. So it's, you know, this is really a wonderful, wonderful development. And I can't say enough about, you know, Charlotte's generosity, but also the kind of can-do attitude that the Montana History Foundation has in helping us to ameliorate this problem.
And again, some of these buildings are still operational as schools or as bed and breakfasts.
Well, yes, some are schools, bed and breakfasts. The Vandalia one is a bed and breakfast. One of my favorites is in Dell in Beaverhead County, and it is a brick cupola-centered kind of school. And the sign says CALF-A, CAFE. And it's wonderful food, too. So people are, you know, some people live in them. I mean, there are a number down the Bitterroot Valley, you know, I know on the East Side Highway, which I take frequently, that are become homes. So I think if you have the imagination and the stick-to-itiveness, you can transform these into really wonderful buildings after they're no longer needed as a schoolhouse.
Ms. Dean, you mentioned a book. What's the name of the book again, and how can people find out more?
Yes. The book is Vision and Voices, Montana's One-Room Schoolhouses, and it can be ordered through the Montana History Foundation here in Helena, or from Charlotte Caldwell's website, which is charlottecaldwell.com, and then also from your favorite independent booksellers. I would put a plug in for them. You can also order it through our website. Just call the Montana History Foundation here in Helena, 406-449-3770, and they will get you a copy right out.
I've been speaking with Patty Dean, Director of Preservation and Sustainability for the Montana Preservation Alliance. Part of me feels oddly compelled to say congratulations for getting on this list. It's not something to be congratulated about, but at least it's raising awareness about these great old buildings.
Right. No, thank you very much. And I always say it's sort of bittersweet to be named to the list, but I will say that it does bring public attention. Many of the sites from Montana that have been named to the endangered list before have emerged victorious, such as the Great Falls Portage. Virginia City was on the list for 3 years running. So we've got a pretty good track record of being able to save important Montana landmarks that have made it onto that list.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight will be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers. Lows will be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms. Highs will be in the upper 50s to mid-60s. For central Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 40s. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers throughout the day. Highs will be in the upper 60s. And for southwest Montana, tonight expect mostly cloudy cloudy skies with scattered rain showers and isolated thunderstorms. Lows will be around 40 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and thunderstorms throughout the day. Highs will be around 60 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Nancy Moore.
We all hear it all the time. The trouble with kids these days is... dot, dot, dot. This line is often followed by a string of complaints that detail the sense of entitlement and addiction to Facebook and other social media we often associate with the millennial generation. But what if that's just not true? I've had the opportunity to work with young people from across Montana, and I'm here to tell you, not only are many of them motivated, intelligent, and selfless, they're here to make change. Farm to Cafeteria Network, a program of the National Center for Appropriate Technology, or NCAT, has recently begun a Growing Leaders program, a network of Montana high school students who are concerned about food and healthy living. These young people bring up issues like genetically modified organisms, school lunch programs, lagging rural economies, and the general disconnect between people and the food on our plates. But in addition to raising concerns, these students are also raising awareness, and they're taking action to right some of the wrongs of our industrial food system. A high school student once told me, "You know, the thing about young people is that we don't get easily discouraged. Adults automatically think, no, that can't be done if it's something that's never been done before. But us, we think, hey, maybe I can be the first person to do that. Let's try it." Perhaps that's what Hellgate High School students were thinking a few weeks back when they approached Mannix Family Beef about purchasing 500 burgers for their school's end-of-the-year picnic. The idea took off, and before long, the student body was enjoying local, grass-fed hamburgers on school property for the first time. Or maybe that's what students in Bozeman were thinking when they dreamed up the Bozone Ozone Bus, a.k.a. Bob. Bob is a greenhouse on wheels that runs on biodiesel and acts as a traveling classroom where teenagers teach elementary school students about growing food. It certainly hadn't been done before, but young people in the Bozeman Youth Initiative made it happen for the first time. We heard even more inspiring examples of Montana's teenagers doing amazing things food-related at the Youth Leadership Retreat that NCAT's Farm to Cafeteria Network organized this past April. At the event, young people used presentations and videos to share their projects with an audience of peers and teachers. In Ravalli County, for instance, an after-school group called the Community Cooking Connections, they prepare and serve a delicious free meal to community members every week. Or in Dillon, where student cadets at Montana Youth Challenge Academy help grow food at UM Western's garden, while at the same time, they discover themselves growing. And in Missoula, teens with Garden City Harvest Program Youth Harvest sell fresh veggies at an affordable price to low-income senior citizens using a mobile market. These examples and many more are proof that the millennial generation cares about healthy living and sustainably grown food, and they're taking matters into their own hands. That's why NCAT's Farm to Cafeteria Network is organizing the first annual Youth Summit this September in Missoula. The Youth Summit is an opportunity for high school students from across the state to come together to share and learn about the importance of reconnecting with our food. Teenagers, as well as adults working with youth, are invited to participate in the event, September 13th and 14th. At the Youth Summit, you'll have the chance to tour youth-led farms, school gardens, and kitchens serving local food. You'll hear from out-of-state youth who use food as a vehicle for social change. You could participate in sessions on topics ranging from permaculture to cultural cooking to GMOs. But above all, at the Youth Summit, you'll be able to connect with other people from across the state, both millennials and adults working with millennials, who know that food matters and who want to create change. For more information about the Youth Summit and how to register, check out our website at www.farmtocafeteria.ncat.com. farmtocafeteria.org. Again, that's www.farmtocafeteria.ncat.org. In Butte, with the National Center for Appropriate Technology, I'm Nancy Moore with the Alternative Energy Resources Organization. Arrow has been linking people with sustainable agriculture and energy solutions since 1974. Visit us online at arrowmt.org.
Nancy Moore is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sari Jovetich. Thanks for listening. And please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.